This is the Forum at Holden Village. And it is not a Chinese restaurant where we are ordering our meals. Tonight, we will be sharing in the series on fear and talking about fear of sexuality, passion, and compassion. And I would like to just open it up without any introductory comments about that to, for any of you, to talk about what you see happening in society that you think is either a hopeful sign or is a very negative sign about how our culture or about how the church is dealing with sexuality. What are you, Joan Novak, a couple questions on that. One, you've been dealing with questions of sexuality in your classes here this week and also teach at Denison University on using the book Embodiment by Nelson and so on. What kinds of things have you sensed in terms of the feelings of your students toward sexuality, and also at Holden, a higher proportion of women who have been interested in your courses than men, and so on?
Okay, well, first of all, I came to hopefully that the student generation, I was sure this student generation would have a much healthier attitude towards sexuality than my generation did. Because my generation was the old ritualized dating patterns where the only time you saw a guy was in a dating situation, highly ritualized, highly formalized. From what I have to say about Denison, and I'll leave it with, I think, upper middle class students, that has not materialized. It seems to me my students are generally very much afraid of sex and sexuality. It seems to me that more than I would have anticipated, casual affairs are often used as means to manipulate people, as failed shortcuts to intimacy that never really develops, as means of manipulation. And although there's more sexual activity than when I was in school, it seems that it has been from only this one population, where I teach the courses with the freshmen, the first-year people. I say that there's a greater fear and alienation and manipulation of sexuality, perhaps even in my generation, and it was very much of a disappointment. So I'll let other people respond to that. That ought to be pretty provocative, at least for the people that are also in college. I'd say at Holden, I think shows what I see is a growing trend, a greater interest in women, and interest in sexuality, and openness and willingness to discuss sexuality, particularly among other women. I don't claim to know what men are feeling.
Thank you. Comments or responses?
I would say that most of the conversations I have that deal with sex, and it's certainly different now that I've been married 5.5 years, you don't seem to talk about it so much. But the conversations I have with men are generally, you're at the clients. I move around from client to client because I am an auditor and I move around. You're there and you're talking. It's usually with some other guy, and the client happens to have an interesting, attractive woman there. And usually that, it's very sexist. And so there is no, I think Joan's comment that it's, I think men are still hung up, and I think that I was too, to a large extent, maybe I still am more than I want to realize, that you're hung up with the idea that even if you are intimate with a woman, you are required to have a certain level of performance of some kind. So in your conversations, you would never let down and think that you don't meet some magical norm set by them, whoever they are. And really, that's about as in-depth as sex gets. And the discussions about men, I don't think men ever break down and really say, I'm not really sure. I'm not sure, that they really care. The only time I think that ever happens is when, very seldom, when I discuss with other married friends, never with single ones. Yeah. sexual relationships with your wife are more intimate and you care. You care about them as a person. But otherwise, the conversations about sexuality are pretty much sexist and are pretty much on a joking level.
Thank you.
I think you have to approach it with a sense of humor, because if you really, everybody likes to sit there and say, hey, you don't mess around, you fool around, all of a sudden this thing, which is a great no-no, you get married, and everything's supposed to change instantaneously. I think it was a great comfort after I got married when I sat there and said to myself, hey, I really don't know what's going on. And it was a great deal of comfort when I found out that neither did my wife. So we had a lot of fun just kind of working it out together and understanding about each other. It's very much a closed book, you know. And if you go to the library and get books and so on and so forth, you can get everything from the very clinical presentation to Mickey Spillane, and you'll still find that until you get to know one another in a married situation, and unless you can approach it with a sense of humor, that the authors don't have it all.
Other comments? Openers.
I think I'll kind of go along with him, but I don't feel threatened by sexuality or anything like that. The only reason I'm here is not because I'm worried about my sexuality or anything like that. I have four women engineers that work for me, and I'm concerned about them. The reason I'm here is as a supervisor, what should I be aware of? That's the only reason I'm here.
Are you married?
I'm married, and I go along entirely with what you say.
So, but were you concerned about it before you were married?
Yes, very much concerned about it before I was married.
I think that's kind of a key.
Yes.
And it probably, after you got married, you sat there and you looked back at it and said, my goodness, it seemed such a concern and so important and was going to be the make or break aspect, the way you look at it before you were married, then all of a sudden afterwards,
yeah, it was a good laugh.
Part of life.
It was a good laugh, and you were both, kind of like you said.
What is your concern? I mean, are you wondering how to deal, you know, to be aware or sensitive to these women's needs, or is that what you're saying?
I'm wondering, is there something out there that I should know about, in particular with regard to sexual harassment, as a matter of fact?
Oh, I see.
I find in the work situation that the other engineers get along with these females just as if there were no such thing as sex.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's on a thought basis. You know, it's really a pretty fine situation. But somewhere out there, maybe I've got a problem. I just don't realize it. A developing problem.
I'd say it's a pretty good situation.
Yeah, it's very helpful.
Because I work with guys almost all my life, mainly guys. And it's pretty, you know, you get along. Sometimes you can have better relationships with them. If you can keep it that way on a friend basis, I don't think there's anything to worry about. They all get along fine, and they're friends. It's the greatest thing. I'll bet those girls appreciate that, too. I would say.
The concern that I would have would be morality I see being thrown out at the public by way of the media. Television, it's so easy to learn what it comes. And our 14-year-old daughter is funding it up. And it's like Dave talking about technology. You can't help but be around technology and have an effect on you think, how you act, no matter how much you try to lead this double, you know, I work now, and I throw it away, and I'm a different person after work. You know, she likes to watch the shows the other kids watch. And we try to limit the watching so she has to pick and choose, not just sit there and drain the evening away, but still. I kind of wonder what effect this is going to have on her. Either she might openly say, that's stupid, or ha ha ha, and that's not the way it is. The plurality you see there is that if you don't get intimate with the person the first time out, then you're prudish, you know, there's, you've got a developmental problem, you're going to join a cloister, you know. You better get the acting off your face.
Do you sense a growth in the whole teasing in the television industry? How many of you have that same fear of what television is doing to create a whole different morality in the country? How many people sense that? I don't know. One of the last things I read in the newspaper before coming into Holden was that Procter & Gamble has withdrawn something like, was it $14 million of advertising from major shows under the pressure of the group that is formed out of Mississippi to bring about greater morality in their terms on television programs. Who else has sensed that, either with papers, or is this a fear that others have? Television, newspaper, well, not newspapers, but the magazine rack. Yeah, the whole culture. Yeah.
One of the things that's kind of frightening about what you said about Procter & Gamble is the fact that immediately when they canceled the advertising, I don't remember what the figure was, but there was a tremendous number of other firms that jumped in and said, hey, I'll take that spot, and the system continued, and in fact, there were many advertisers that were hungry to accept those programs, and were not the least bit concerned about public pressure.
Are we wandering off the topic? I just get this feeling like we shifted to employee relationships, friendships, advertising, movies, and I'm wondering if we're kind of shying away from what the word sex means in a person's actual experience, the feelings that are there. I just get the feeling that this conversation is drifting off, and I'm wondering, I don't know, maybe
Are you talking sexuality in the context of the bedroom, or sexuality in terms of the context of life? And I think that would probably answer your question as to whether people are wandering off or not.
Is it a little bit the question of, are we talking about Madison Avenue, or are we talking about passion and compassion? I don't know, but I think, you know, that's what you're asking. It seems more like going to advertising.
That's one of my biggest concerns with Madison Avenue, though. It's all passion, no compassion. I would think it would be more discouraging than anything. Most of the sex is portrayed. I would have second thoughts about being involved.
You speak with a lot of people. Just that a lot of the sex is portrayed in advertising. It seems like, at least me, really ambivalent about being involved sexually with somebody. And to me, that's what we're talking about. Advertising and society's view of sexuality more than that it's encouraging people. I don't know.
Well, we're told not to be encouraged about sex. I mean, that up through childhood and up through young adult, it's a hot coal. Nobody really wants to talk about it. Even here, I don't know how much people want to talk about the effect that their growing years had upon their adult approach to sex and their sexuality as a person. And I teach seventh graders, and they are really dealing very out front with the way they feel about it. it's a shock to me because I had elementary children up through this year, and I'm learning a whole bunch things I didn't know, things that they know now that I'm surprised, and sometimes I kind of back off because they know the language very well. They're very familiar with a lot of things, and yet they don't have that sense of the loving compassion that goes with all of the words, the pop talk, the imagery that they catch from all the television and radio and so on and so forth. And it's I think the place that they get the most important rules and regulations are models at home. And if they don't have strong family models, of which most children that I work with don't, then they have all kinds of screwed up ideas about what it's like to be a compassionate person. And trying to teach them that within the context of a school situation is real tough. And I really say that if you're a strong family model, then I don't think you have to worry so much about all the extra externals, because they're seeing it right there. But if that family isn't together, then they'll look for anything that will be a success symbol to them. And if it's Dukes of Hazzard's way of doing it, that's what it's going to be. And open discussion at home. Nobody's fiddling around behind the corners, not saying it directly to them. They're not dumb, and they're certainly seeing everything there is to see. But the feeling, the gut level, has to be in home.
Harvey, I'd like to follow up on that, because that's been something that I thought a lot about. How do families and churches, I mean, I was not allowed to dance through college because you weren't allowed to touch your dance body. I was told from the day I started dating that holding hands and maybe kissing was all right, but absolutely nothing else. I have a feeling that there was something very wrong about sex, or that it was dirty, or that at least it was to be done only in the context of marriage. All of a sudden, you're married, and I suppose I pass on some of that to my children. I wonder how you say that our bodies are beautiful and sexuality is beautiful and we should enjoy one another's bodies, but just this day you don't and the next day you do, and rather you're supposed to know all about sex. I mean, I think the church perpetuates this bad theology about the beautiful people we are and how we enjoy one another. But I don't want promiscuity, and I don't, I really think that's a problem. I don't know what parents or what churches do or what the young people here think. Is that their experience, and are they supposed to?
I feel like I grew up with a real healthy attitude, and I don't know if I can be real specific about why, but it was it was never a secret in our house, but it wasn't like we had a forum every night after dinner either.
You didn't have a fireplace.
No, not a circular one anyway. And but I just always felt like that it was something that, as far as morally, there was, it was obvious, and I always grew up with, there was no sex before marriage, but that once you were married, that was a part, a real integral part of the relationship, and that's what made it so special, and that there was, I never felt like I had to read a manual or wonder what anyone else was doing to see if I was doing it right, or... And I think a lot was because my family was, everyone ran around in pajamas and you need to wash your hands, and someone was in the bathtub, that was okay. And I don't know, it was just kind of an open, no one closed their, it wasn't a lot of hidden kind of stuff. And so it was just real natural, and I was always appreciative about that. And since people who have married into our family, and it just kind of, there's a lot of comfort in that as well. And, I don't know. It was just never dirty, It was never.
But I think Mary's point is very clear, because when we look at
kinds of sins that the church gets real excited about. The church hardly ever gets excited about justice, sins about that are concerned with justice. But if someone commits a sexual sin, that's sin, very clearly. And I think the church gets real excited about any expression of love. Can look at the issue of gays, and the church gets really excited about that. And sometimes I think that people don't realize that sometimes people do love each other in those kinds of relationships. And so I think that the church's attitude over the years is the sexual sin, but it's a greater sin than any other. And I think that's that theology. And I think that this problem with sexuality has also had to do with the loss of our tradition about dancing in worship, how we can use dance to communicate theology or just express joy. So I think that that concern about sexuality is related to that, affected our worship too.
How much of this is local? By local, I mean the fact that this country, I think, has a very difficult time being openly, honestly emotional, particularly for a man. You know, you fall down and spin your knee, you're not supposed to cry. Be a big boy now, don't cry. So on and so forth. We do an excellent job, and I'll get Mr. Bella going here, in terms of dealing with it in a very technical sense. You can probably write, buy all kinds of books and bore yourself silly on sexual technique and do step A, do step B. Very little about the emotional aspects of it. Very little about the basic foundational relationship between two people that allows it to be either a successful part of a total marriage relationship or an absolute disaster on which gets pinned, in many cases, all of the blame for several other things that may be wrong with a marriage or a relationship. I don't think this society does a very good job about talking about emotional things.
I would say that's probably true, because I don't know about anybody else in this room, but I have struggled very hard to try to be compassionate and to learn compassion. And I'll be damned, when I was 17, being passionate was the easiest thing in the world.
That's right.
I mean, I don't know about anybody else. I mean, it was very easy to be passionate in terms of being sexually aroused or whatever you want to say. So obviously you go with what's easy. And then that seems to be the nature of the North American society. And maybe of man in general. I don't know. I've never lived anywhere else for any extended period of time up here. But why, we don't want to work at the things that are hard because we want instantaneous rewards. And sex has got to be the most instantaneous of any reward and gratification of anything you can possibly do. I mean, that's the way I look at it, and I agree with what you're saying. And I think
that's true from both the male and the female's point of view?
Yes, and only because, without trying to age you, I'm in a different generation than you are. And I'll tell you that the generation that I'm in and the one that's behind me, that my younger brother and sister, who are 12, 13 years younger than I am, that's true for both sexes from what I can see.
Andrew Green has a book out that just came to the bookstore yesterday called Sexual Intimacy. One chapter is entitled The Insatiable Female. They said that we're not for our culture in this country, well, and in civilized Western world, that the female has more of a sexual appetite and is literally can be insatiable, but it's our worries and our culture that has made it very difficult for women to express their sexuality. That if our culture is getting away, or if it's been with other people, so that's
something I've noticed in both sexes in my age group is the fear of taking any risks, you know, just their history of marriages, it seems. And it goes along with what Mary just said, too. I think a lot of men read a woman as being passionate rather than as compassionate. They think they're being hunted when you want to hug them or put your hand on their arm or something like this. They read it as totally asexual and not compassionate.
You're saying a woman reads that in a man? If you as a woman reach out as a man, as
a
your
man
friend?
A man reads that.
A man reads that in the woman?
Of a woman, yeah.
I'd say more than that.
I'm sure it works that way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, if you want to be misunderstood ever, especially in a business situation, I mean, that's one of the worst things I struggle with, is that there are some women that I work with. I mean, public accounting, I think, and I will put it up there as hold it up there as the one place, in public accounting, as that sector of business has done more to be equal as far as treating men and male and female, and their chances are just as great for women there as they are for men. It's better than any other particular area of business. But there are some women there that I know now after working for them for a year and a half that I like talking to them. We've gone, some of them are married, you know, my wife and I go over and we meet them. We're not really good friends with them, but I know them, and I can see some days at work. It's a frustrating business to be in, and they're really hurting. I can do everything I can in my power to talk to them, but as soon as I touch them, I've blown it. I cannot reach out and touch them. I cannot reach out and just put my arm on their shoulder. I can't reach out and I can't hug them. You know, I am so limited by that. Because they read that, either they read that or the people around them read that as sexual, I don't think necessarily as harassment, but obviously a sexual advance.
But
of
that's
some kind.
Society here, I think, not theological. Because in different countries and in different areas, that's very, very different. You'll get in just as much trouble putting your arm around a man in terms of how it will be read, even if it's just on the shoulder or touching somebody on the shoulder. In a working situation, that can be very threatening in this society, and
that's
very much an authority, hierarchical, whatever.
That's true, but in that hierarchy, I find it's very easy for a partner. CPA firms, public accounting firms are partnership, not corporations, so a partner, right? He's part owner of the business, he's one of the big shots. It's really easy for him to walk up, and if he wants to talk to me, it's okay for him to put his hand on my shoulder as we're walking down the hall saying he's talking to me.
That's not a compassion.
Yeah, but you'll get a very, very different reaction if you do it to him, if he's the partner and you're not.
That's true. Sometimes I do.
That's his problem.
But I share his problem.
How many of you who are in churches or out of churches, getting back to the question that Mary raised, have experienced a different style or a different attitude toward sexuality? And how did that happen? I think some of the talk about the ease with which it's dealt in the family is one way. How about the rest of society? Are there other places, other institutions, where it has been much easier to feel much freer about your sexuality that any of you have experienced? That would be helpful for others to hear.
I was going to say, in light of the church, there was one small glimmer of hope that I witnessed last year. The Catholic Separated and Divorced Group had a regional conference in Billings, and we had a session led by a priest on sexuality. He was a young man, I suppose 35, very charming, very handsome. And he told about the times that he had to deal with single people who came to him for counsel about their sexual activities. And then he began to talk about the times he was horny. And I thought, praise the Lord, Catholic priests are human too. But there aren't many priests among the group of that we came in contact with who would ever say anything like that or ever admit they would dare counsel.
Other responses.
I wanted to respond to this fellow up here. Yeah. If he thinks it's difficult in a CPA firm, he should be a male teacher. Male teachers really have it laid on them from the time kids are probably 10, 11 years old. Male teachers are afraid to comfort because of society and what will be interpreted through that, you know. Normal hugging of kids, you know. And that's one time I'm really glad I'm a female, that I can just pull that kid in and really hug him. And yet I see frustration in the fifth and sixth grade teachers that those kids need that, and junior high kids need, you know, the punch on the arm and the squeeze and everything, and it's bad that, well, of course, one of our sixth grade teachers, a guy, neat looking guy, got pinched on the buns by a sixth grade girl. And, which is also bad because he didn't quite, you know, he called her aside and talked with her and said, now your parents would really be embarrassed if they knew what you did. And yet he had that underlying fear. What if she goes home and says, I initiated that? And it's awful that he has to have that fear.
Joe?
I'd like to ask Bob if, you know, when you say you feel inhibited putting your arm around, you know, the women, your women colleagues, and if you have that same desire to comfort and feel the same inhibition with male colleagues.
Yes, but the inhibition goes both ways, that I feel inhibited more with the male colleagues too, because not that I fear my sexuality, that I fear there's some kind of desire for the male there, but because there's a whole lot of barriers to break down, I think, between two men, and it would go back to this gentleman over here, his comments, that we are afraid of that. But yes, I do feel that, and yes, if I was to do that, there would be problems there too, that they wouldn't understand that in a business, quote, business situation, why I'm comforting that person, you know, that there has to be some kind of physical touching as a comfort to them to let them know that someone cares. But yeah, I have wanted to do that, and I have not. And it's been also the fear of what the reaction is going to be, that I'm not allowed to do that, and also maybe some other internal fears that I wouldn't fear hugging a woman. Now, you know, maybe that's just sexual bias still on my part, that part of it, but it's mostly the business situation.
Well, I think, you know, one thing one might have to be careful of is if you're dealing with a colleague, it might seem paternalistic to comfort them
in
a certain way that would imply a dominant subordination that would not be appreciated even if it wasn't sexual harassment.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that's a real problem. I can talk with you more about that later.
I think also that happens most frequently when the roles aren't clearly defined. You know, how you relate to each other. If it's not clearly defined that this isn't really going into a sexual relationship, this is just clearly a platonic thing, I want to hug you, it usually doesn't have too much of a problem. And I don't know, I guess the longer period of time that you get to know someone that you clearly define the roles, it becomes an easier sort of thing. I think it's also pretty clearly defined in other ways too, institutionalized, like here, in a sense that we all, there's a lot of hugging going on here, a lot more than you find in Seattle or Spokane or something like that. And I think it's because it's defined that it's okay. And that our rules are defined, that we're all villagers, we're all part of a community. If I hug you, it's because I want to express a friendly love towards you, rather than anything that could go any further. The rules are defined.
The question was on the floor with respect to, did you notice differences outside of the church versus in the church situation? And I remember very distinctly when I was single in Syracuse, New York, floating around trying to determine how to make social contacts in a strange town. And you hit the singles bars and you're not too comfortable in that situation. And if you ever want to spend an evening looking at people uncomfortable, go to a popular singles bar and get yourself in a corner and just observe people if you're not there. And I met my wife through a young adult group which was associated with one of the churches, associated with the university campus that was in town. And the people that were there and came there and enjoyed that group from all different backgrounds and interests, I think the one thing that held the group together was people comfortable in meeting new people and feeling that there wasn't going to be a great deal of pressure. You didn't feel like you were expected to pick somebody up for an overnight quickie, nor did the gals who came there feel like they were going to be pressured in that type of situation. So in that particular sense, it was a very, very positive, almost a safe haven for those who were shy or maybe I shouldn't even say that. I think most people are uncomfortable in a singles bar, even those who would run around bragging about how great it is and how many people they meet there.
Yes.
I'd like to go back to the issue that, Mary brought up, and as far as families are concerned, I see healthy sexuality being a priority that needs to come first before a person can have a healthy sex life. And I see the two terms sometimes being used interchangeably here, and I see them as being very, very different. Not everyone has sex at every point in their life, but everyone has sexuality from the moment they're conceived. I think the process is starting then. And I don't think they're synonyms, but yet I feel like in a discussion, almost every discussion that I'm in, they tend to get used that way. It gets real vague, and I feel uncomfortable with that.
Sexuality and sex and whatever you else want to use related to the word love and how much love is shown within a family, love in its Christian sense and compassion and caring. And I just know as a school teacher, when you tell kids in the classroom that you love them, you get very strange reactions because they don't know what the word means. You know, if I could go up to a 11-year-old boy and say, hey, talking about, why did you do that? It's because I love you. He squirms if he doesn't understand what I'm trying to say. So I think this is somewhere, whether it be in the relaxed atmosphere of the home that she's talking about, I think relaxation comes from how love is transmitted.
You can't blame the 12-year-old because most adults do the same thing if they aren't related to you.
Mm-hmm. Well, it depends on how it comes across. I'm talking about in the Christian sense. In Christian sense, we should love each other.
For people. Most people don't take that well either. I mean, they may go home and think about it and think that was nice, but they don't take it well when it happens.
It's threatening.
Mm-hmm. What do I do with it?
What are you expecting from me?
Mm-hmm. What's it going to cost me?
We're not used to it because there isn't enough of it.
It doesn't cost you anything. It's a free gift.
I know, but everybody's been told there's no free meal.
That's not what the Bible says.
I have been teaching 8th grade for 3 years, and I think that with verbally telling people, young or old, that you care for them, you kind of, especially like in a public school setting where everyone's coming from a different background, you kind of need to speak their language. And a lot of, you know, they're not, maybe they are used to saying I love you to people in their family, or maybe they're not, but you can usually, you know, say that you care about them. And some children are really uncomfortable with that, but most of them aren't. You know, I mean, I think that you can kind of, if you want to be able to talk about how you feel with them, you just have to start doing it and kind of be gentle about it and figure out, you know, how much they're comfortable with it. And they come around. Mine do. You know, I mean, they're all at different places, but they all grow in their ability to verbalize what they're feeling. I think that they do. And then also about, because I work in schools, you know, talking about touching people and hugging, you know, just formal touching people in work situations. I think that our school is small and it's a much less formal situation than like a CPA firm or something. But I thank you. I would imagine.
You're pretty close to being right on.
Yeah. I just think that for me, it seems like you just have to be sensitive to what individuals you're dealing with, because with the adults I work with, some women and some men, I'm really comfortable in touching. You know, some of them hug me and some of them don't. Other ones, it's just sort of like, I understand that that isn't something that they're comfortable with, so we just kind of figure it out. And it's like that with children, too. Some of them I hug, And you know, some of them I can touch, and others, you know, I sense right away that they're really uncomfortable with it, and so, you know, that's not a part of how I relate to them. But I don't, in my situation, I, you know, that just isn't what it's happening.
Well, I think that what you said about children brought this point home to me, is that you can't, hugging is a two-person thing, and you can't just assume that the other person wants a hug, so you're going to hug them. I mean, you've got to, hugging or kissing or holding hands or whatever you're going to do that you can get away with here is going to be something that takes two people that are going to communicate about it. So to say, just to go up and hug the kid or hug another person is a dangerous thing to do. You have to be able to be sensitive enough to feel out what that person's going to want. I mean, it's...
Does it become something you technically analyze then, in which case it loses all its spontaneity, or what? You know, I mean, I'm just asking you a question. I'm not saying you're wrong. But...
I think there is a certain amount of attack in a sense that goes on that, especially I noticed with kids, that you assume somebody's cute, so you pick them up and you hug them. Well, the kid doesn't want to be hugged. I think when we get into problems with relationships, with somebody touching me, or somebody touching somebody else, or somebody putting their arm around somebody else, they're not wanting to be touched at that moment, or not wanting to be hugged, or they don't know you, or you're frightening them because you move too fast, or something. I think we have to be really sensitive about that, because that may be one of the places you get into trouble.
I think it may be a risk worth taking.
But I think the flip side of what was just mentioned here, I think it's even more dangerous to verbalize love and caring if you don't really, because it isn't going to come across, and you may feel like you should be verbalizing care and compassion in a certain situation for a certain individual, but don't even try if you don't really feel it.
That's very true.
Because there's too many other aspects to communication other than the verbal, and it just isn't going to make it.
People were going to realize, you know, whether you mean it or not, too. I work with kids, and boy, if you tell one of the kids, you know, I really care about you, and you don't show it, they know what you're sending across to them.
What are some, again, some situations that can break down the rigidity that exists between what we sense as sexuality and how that bridges into sex? Any of you in your churches or school classrooms, is there anything that has happened to be able to loosen people, to be freer about themselves, about their bodies, and about each other?
I teach fourth grade, and sometimes they'll come in and say, you know, so-and-so said a bad word on the playground, and we talk about that words are only bad and how you think about that word, and talk about what the meanings are and why somebody would use that word. And sometimes, you know, kids are starting to exercise their vocabulary, and oftentimes the wrong vocabulary, and their sexual connotations to those words. And they're usually pretty receptive to that because they are exploring with their language and everything else. And I think they need people that don't get uptight when they start using those words, and that you're willing to, you know, start telling them what some of the correct terminology is and what people are meaning by that.
I remember certain times in life when something strikes you as that this is important. And I learned to read before school by reading sports books. I enjoyed sports. So Sport Magazine, when it first was out in around 1950, and boxing and wrestling magazine and ring magazine, Street and Smith's football yearbook, etc. And I remember in the kitchen one evening reading about Jim Rivera, who was an outfielder for the Chicago White Sox. And it was a story about Jim Rivera and his comeback after being accused on a rape charge. And so this was interesting, and I asked my mother, who was making corn fritters or something like that at the time, what is rape? And the fritters about hit the ceiling. And it was something about, well, that was a serious crime. And then that was it. But the intensity with which those fritters went up in here, let me know. Told me that that there is something very interesting that is here. So, I think the ease with which we can, I hope I learned something from that to not be able to do that, at least to internalize some things in dealing with my daughter when she comes up with those questions when that happens. Jen?
I've worked with college students for a few years and done some sexuality seminars and things. And I hope that this comment isn't taken wrong, but somebody over here said something about humor. And I think there is a certain element that helps with that. It's people are embarrassed and they have that those laughs and giggles inside of them, and I found that to start things out, just to start talking about, you know, when did you find out about sex, and when did you start learning about your own sexuality, and people have wonderful stories to tell, and they're funny, and if you can get some of that out, and then it gets on, then you can start to talk about the things that are important, get that over with.
Good.
We can't laugh at ourselves, we can laugh at
them. Dave, have you got your...
I think the point you raised before, that the church provided a social environment where people could gather together and meet each other within a non-threatening source. It somehow withdrew you from the rest of the world and provided a safe place where you could meet people. And that's a very valuable thing I think that the churches do. It is very age dependent though. There's a window there, and I think people feel pressure, you know, the opportunities for meeting people, and I think a lot of times they jump into marriages too quickly because it gets harder and harder the older you get. And that does happen. The other thing though, in contrast to that, is what you said about the word love, that somehow on the outside world, you got to really watch where you use that word. And that says something about the church. It says a lot of the language and the ways we're talking, you can't use out there. You really can't. It's tough. I mean, we can say it in a place like this, well, let's love everyone and stuff like that. And you go on out, and I think like you were saying, you really have to watch out where you use that word love. It's really hard work. So in one case, we have the success of the church in bringing people together. In the other case, maybe some of the words we use and the way we talk about things are different in the church than what you encounter in the real world. I found that. Yeah,
but I was thinking your Christianity, your faith should come out outside too.
Yeah, but we have to learn how to deal in that world lovingly. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's hard to even translate the words. I mean, sometimes it's really hard, and I think that's why your observation of, you know, I think was very right. You have to watch out how to use that word, and I think that's the kind of thing we need to talk about in church. How do you be loving in that world?
Yeah, and the mix-up that some people have of, you know, that God is love, but love is not God.
Okay, now the thing you were asking me, I've been doing a series on technology. Some of you may have come to it, and I've described technology as a set of expectations that are placed upon people. Okay? You say, what does that have to do with sex? Well, what I did is I identified some of those expectations on a piece of paper. And when I did that, I had nothing to do with sex. And I wasn't even thinking, I was looking at an engineering mechanics course and so forth and so on. But I'd like to read some of them to you. And I think they reflect some of the things people have said, particularly the men, with regard to their fears in terms of sex, because of the kinds of expectations in the broad society that are placed on them. Okay? And so I'll read these, and remember, these are the technological, this is the society we work, live in, and I'd like to read a few of them, and you can listen to them in the context of our discussion on sex. Evaluations should be based upon observations of performance. Time is a resource that should be used efficiently and not wasted. Activities should be planned, organized, and controlled so as to meet specified objectives and minimize unanticipated changes, surprises, and disorders. Tasks should be broken down into workable parts which can be explained, completed, and evaluated in a practical and orderly manner. Get this last one. Communicated evidence should be independent of personal feelings, emotions, needs, and experiences. It should be objective, factual, and non-subjective. Okay. Now, where I identified these is I tried to say, what is the essence of technology? And I came up with, there's a kind of a background of expectations that people place on each other. And because people share those expectations and they place them on each other, we have such things as electric lights and planes and boats and all the rest of that stuff that makes the world work. If they didn't do these things, we wouldn't have those. Well, how do you jump from this world into the world of compassion and sexuality? And I think the laughter we have is because these things just don't fit that world. But how do you switch? You can't expect to live in all that and not have it, and all of a sudden, and I think men are afraid of this, and that's why when you talked about women's sexuality, what, the insatiable, what was it?
Yeah.
I mean, that's scary to men. I mean, you know, evaluation should be based upon observations of performance, and here you've got this insatiable, you know, standard that you're supposed to perform. I mean, that's scary. So you can't, and I'm referring to men because they're probably more dominated by, I think, the technological expectations than women are in our culture. I'm not saying that their skills are in different than that, but they're more dominated by that. And I've heard a lot, like the one guy up there said, well, we're expected to perform. When you say we can't show our feelings. And those things do reflect something that is a characteristic of our culture. And how you make that switch, that's part of the frustration. And I think when we laugh, the laugh and the fear, humor and tragedy are kind of intertwined together. When I read these things, I laugh, and then I say, oh, God. Because there's a lot of reality there. So we're dealing with a problem. Maybe what we, by understanding more about the fears we have in sexuality, we're going to understand much more about ourselves in a much broader context than that, in a broader society that we live within. And it's tough.
Joe?
Yeah, I just want to ask Dave a question. When you were reading that, and I'm not sure I understood you or if you meant to say this or not, but when you were reading those, and I was thinking of, you know, sex, I thought of that those expectations would apply to a lot of sex manuals, the way they're written.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's the, you know, a technological approach to sex. But then in the process, compassion, those kinds of things that, like you were saying, how do you measure that? How do you analyze that? And you were saying, well, can you analyze that? that those things don't fit very well. And yet, it turns out the things in our culture that we're very good at, the technological, you know, that may block us off from some things that we're not very good at.
There's some theorists who think that what happens with the whole openness toward sexuality in our culture will bring us away from the technological. The openness very much is in kind of a technological performance genre at this point, but that eventually the thing that holds us as a people or holds humanity back from making breakthroughs in terms of compassion are all the fears of sexuality that have been built up, and that when all those barriers are gone, the barriers that create war, that create great sense of competition, the barriers that build up in international life, that those will come down, and that a breakthrough is occurring, that it wasn't so much out of the 60s, that the enduring stands would be those that were the social justice issues, but out of the 60s, in the long term, the whole counterculture values of sex are the ones that are going to allow people to get along better in the future. Are there that we become less technological by becoming much more open about sexuality?
I'm not sure how that ends wars.
In the long run, that we free a free society that does not build up restrictions about or that does not create a people who are uptight, if you want to use that word, about anything, eventually loses a lot of the division that keeps people from being able to love each other culturally across all kinds of boundaries. Very much in line with Willem Reich's theories of Orson Bean's book, Me and the Oregon, raising a sense of body and appreciation of that, and losing a sense of fear of sexuality in relationship to any other person.
That doesn't seem to make much sense, though, because we're becoming more technological rather than less technological. I think if you heard the people speaking here tonight, they said that, you know, they know a lot more about sex today, the younger ones particularly, that they feel a lot less willing to take a risk. And I think that's relating to the advance of technology and, you know, the continuation of technology in the future. So rather than becoming more open, it's becoming more closed in some ways.
You can find out anything you want written technically, to your point. You can find volumes, but very little that focuses on the emotional, loving building of a relationship.
Oh, I don't know, in the bookstore there's a really good book called Self-Esteem is a Family Affair. And to me that says the whole thing, that if you see me as an individual and I see you as an individual, that's where it's at. I'm not a female on the make and you're not a guy on the make, and we're individuals with needs and we need to be related on that level. You know, if you really look for it, there are an awful lot of books on feelings and relating and relationships that are breaking down the sexuality barriers.
But they aren't necessarily what are being used or emphasized in those programs that are available in schools or so on or so forth. Because of the inhibitions that most people have of getting into that area, it tends to stay very clinical.
I would disagree with the school district I come from. Yeah.
Yeah.
There are a lot of drug and alcohol programs that are gearing into the self-concept area, which is the whole, you know, part of drug and alcohol education now. I think high schools, at least where I come from, have a contemporary living course where they talk about dating, marriage, you know, finances, relating to people. And I think that if you don't have it in your school district, I think as a concerned parent, you need to really get on it, because there is a lot of material available that can be used. And you might be surprised what your teachers are really teaching in between.
I agree that we have all kinds of verbal and written stuff, but what those kids need is visual action that they can observe. I'm a teacher, and I know at least half the kids have divorced parents. They never see affection. And if it isn't their uncles or their sisters or an aunt or a grandmother that shows affection, they never see it. Because you don't see it on TV that much. You see it in a sexual manner rather than an affectionate manner. And I think people are a lot like birds. Some flocks of birds have to have a certain amount of numbers, like say over 70, for them to do their mating, courtship rituals. If it gets under 30, you might as well write them off as extinct, because they don't see what's going on. They don't know how to do the things. And I think people are like that, because if there's not enough of it going around, they don't want to be a minority. They want to be in a majority. We're too oriented with what most everybody else is doing. Yeah.
That's interesting you say that, because if we say it has to happen in the home, and the size of the flock that's needed is really bigger than the home, the nuclear family, we may be putting, in our day and age, unrealistic expectations on that family. And maybe one of the reasons why we have a lot of divorces is because people are trying so darn hard to meet some of these unrealistic expectations. Maybe what we need to do is provide more niches like Holden, where there's a bigger flock, and your community in the church where there was a bigger flock where people could gather together and see that. That is so hard. That is so hard to find those places, because we categorize people so much, and it's just really hard to find a place like Holden or a place like you're talking about where you can meet people freely and have that caring compassion. And I think you're right. I think you're right that people have to see it in action. And actually see people hug each other and see that happen. And really, the books aren't going to make much difference. I think the books just kind of reflect what's going on in society. But if you really want to change it, maybe we have to make these flocks. And maybe, you know, the idea of just having the nuclear family be the flock, that may not, it may be like those birds. It's not big enough. That's interesting.
Thank you.
I guess I don't know really how to say this, and I may come out really stupid, but I've been sitting here and thinking, because there's some in our group, we talk about it every once in a while, as single people in our church, never married. You know, when you were brought up strict, when you hear love on the from the pulpit, but where else do you see love? Even in the church, I mean, we do in the group like this, like you're saying in the groups. But where do you share in the people, like you were saying, you're afraid to touch the people at work. You know, where does anybody, where is anything? Where is it? You know, you wonder where do you get it? Where do you share it? Where is it? And your family was the old German family. Nobody ever showed affection. I don't think I ever heard of the word love outside of Sunday school and God loving you till I was out and dating, and that had to be after high school. I mean, did some before, but my parents didn't know about it. But because I stayed away from home to go to high school. But where, what was love, and how do you do it? How do you share? What do you know? Sure, I have been dating, and I've done a lot of that, but it's never panned out to be anything more than that. And there wasn't any sex in my dating. You know, sure, there's sexual. I mean, because you're the male and female, and things are. Nature, but as far as indulging in sex itself, there was none. Well, how, you know, what do you learn? What do you know? How do you feel? Sometimes you wonder, you know, and I guess this seemed like a time to share it.
Yeah.
Well, in another side of it, I've been single for a long time, and I'm divorced, and I never realized what a cocoon marriage can be. That you're really sheltered and you don't have to face a lot of those things. But to be in your 30s and be divorced and have to face the whole question of sex and sexuality really blows your mind. And it takes a long time to get things straight. And I guess one of the sadnesses that I have some really good friendships, but in, I don't know how many years, we've probably been invited as a family maybe two or three times to their homes to be included. I can think of one time that one of the husbands, and I felt like when I was married that we were equally, you know, friends with both male and female. One husband called me once when his wife was gone. He had a crisis with a daughter, and he said, "Help!" And that's the only time. Otherwise, singles are left out. And I guess the little church that I go to is a hugging community, and I feel like for me and my children, we are a family. And I'm not called a single parent, we're called a family. And I guess, you know, those of you who are married might think, when was the last time you had a single parent or a single person at your table and thought of them just as a person that needs the conversation, needs to be included?
You know, a lot of it, though, is it has to be a really strong marriage. It's strange. Yeah. It really,
and this is where sexuality really
it really has. And that's why I think a lot of the marriages aren't any better off than a lot of the divorces. I mean, and you see this, because I'm divorced, and I've seen that, you know. And if you really get a couple, they're really together, and you really, really see the love that they have, they'll ask you. But there's just, that's rare. It's frightening. I mean, it's frightening how rare that is.
And we certainly are not comfortable with if your husband called up an old friend and decided to go for dinner or coffee, you know, how comfortable would you be with that? Or a husband having his wife see an old male friend. You know, boy, when you get married, you really click off, you know, and you're no longer entitled to have friendships with the opposite sex.
One of the things, in response to where you find this loving group, I think churches originally started out as loving groups. And then they got large, or other things happened, and that changed. But within the last 8 or 9 years, more and more they've been promoting small groups within churches, many small groups within churches, of people who can become intimate in terms of what they think and what they want to talk about. And one of the things they caution you about in this, there's all the manuals for
technocracy. Small group manual, you're right.
They say, look out, because one of the things that happens quite frequently among these groups is you start having affairs. Because people really cannot handle, because of our, of, I don't know what, intimacy yet. The culture, because of, I don't know what, because of what, but it's, I've been belonged to a small group for a long time, and we really had we grew close together. One of the couples did divorce. We've had in our house, but it's one of the things they warn you about. You know, don't get too close, or you know, things are going to happen here in the morning.
That's right. Sometimes they're right. That's what's scary.
But it's a hard thing to break out of, to be close to a person on a sharing basis and not have sex become involved. Because it's almost like you've been taught that once you get close in the sharing one, then you have to have the sex as well. You can't have the force of character and vice versa.
I wonder, I agree with what you're saying. I wonder though, if for those people who had the affairs, if it wasn't the first time they got into a group where they really felt that somebody else really cared, and maybe in their marriage they've never really felt that the other spouse really cared. So then you've got a group together now showing. I mean, it sounds almost ridiculous. I mean, the group, idealistically you want them to come together and find each other again in some kind of romantic idea. But a lot of times that just is not the way it is. A lot of times there's people who are in marriages who are going to those groups because they really feel lost and they don't feel any kind of belonging. They're you know, there's just nothingness out there almost. And when they get into those groups, where they really find it, they feel that somebody, you know, a group cares for them, but they also find another person who really cares for them. And I can see how it would be really easy for a lot of affairs to happen.
I think Bob, you had the last word, right. Thank you for coming for a very reflective evening where it seemed that the theme was much more on compassion and maybe where we can pick up ideas from each other for churches or schools or for ourselves.